14. Amongst these symbols of decline, the most conspicuous is the notion of entropy, which forms the subject of the second law of thermodynamics. The first law, that of the conservation of energy, is the plain formulation of the essence of dynamics, not to say of the constitution of the West European soul, to which nature is necessarily visible only in the form of a contrapuntal dynamic causality, as against the static plastic causality of Aristotle. The basic element of the Faustian world picture is not the attitude, but the deed, and, mechanically considered, the process. And this law merely puts the mathematical character of these processes into form as variables and constants. But the second law goes deeper and shows a bias in nature happenings which is in no wise imposed a priori by the conceptual fundamentals of dynamics. Mathematically, entropy is represented by a quantity which is fixed by the momentary state of a self-contained system of bodies, and under all physical and chemical alterations can only increase, never diminish. In the most favourable conditions, it remains unchanged. Entropy, like force and will, is something which, to anyone for whom this form world is accessible at all, is inwardly clear and meaningful, but is formulated differently by every different authority, and never satisfactorily by any. Here again, the intellect breaks down where the world feeling demands expression. Nature processes in general have been classified as irreversible and reversible, according as entropy is increased or not. In any process of the first kind, free energy is converted into bound energy. And if this dead energy is to be turned once more into living, this can only occur through the simultaneous binding of a further quantum of living energy in some second process. The best known example is the combustion of coal. That is, the conversion of the living energy stored up in it into heat bound by the gas form of the carbon dioxide, if the latent energy of water is to be translated into steam pressure and thereafter into motion. It follows that in the world as a whole, entropy continually increases. That is, the dynamic system is manifestly approaching to some final state, whatever this may be. Examples of the irreversible processes are conduction of heat, diffusion, friction, emission of light and chemical reactions. Of reversible, gravitation, electric oscillations, electromagnetic waves and sound waves. What has never hitherto been fully felt, and what leads me to regard the entropy theory, 1850, as the beginning of the destruction of that masterpiece of Western intelligence, the old dynamic physics, is the deep opposition of theory and actuality, which is here for the first time introduced into theory itself. The first law had drawn the strict picture of a causal nature happening, but the second law, by introducing irreversibility, has for the first time brought into the mechanical logical domain a tendency belonging to immediate life, and thus in fundamental contradiction with the very essence of that domain. If the entropy theory is followed out to its conclusion, it results, firstly, that in theory all processes must be reversible, which is one of the basic postulates of dynamics, and is reasserted with all rigour in the law of the conservation of energy. But, secondly, that in actuality processes of nature in their entirety are irreversible. Not even under the artificial conditions of laboratory experiment can the simplest process be exactly reversed. That is, a state once passed cannot be re-established. Nothing is more significant of the present condition of systematics than the introduction of the hypotheses of elementary disorder for the purpose of smoothing out the contradiction between intellectual postulate and actual experience. The smallest particles of a body an image no more, throughout perform reversible processes. But in actual things, the smallest particles are in disorder and mutually interfere. And so the irreversible process that alone is experienced by the observer is linked with increase of entropy by taking the mean probabilities of occurrences. And thus theory becomes a chapter of the calculus of probabilities, and in lieu of exact, we have statistical methods. Evidently, the significance of this has passed unnoticed. Statistics belong, like chronology, to the domain of the organic, to fluctuating life, to destiny and incident, and not to the world of laws and timeless causality. As everyone knows, statistics serve above all to characterize political and economic, that is, historical, developments. In the classical mechanics of Galileo and Newton, there would have been no room for them. And if now, suddenly, the contents of that field are supposed to be understood and understandable only statistically and under the aspect of probability, instead of under that of the a priori exactitude which the Baroque thinkers unanimously demanded, what does it mean? It means that the object of understanding is ourselves. The nature known in this wise is the nature that we know by way of living experience, that we live in ourselves. What theory asserts, and being itself must assert, to wit, this ideal irreversibility that never happens in actuality, represents a relic of the old severe intellectual form, the great Baroque tradition that had contrapuntal music for twin sister. But the resort to statistics shows that the force that that tradition regulated and made effective is exhausted. Becoming and become, destiny and causality, historical and natural science elements are beginning to be confused. Formulae of life, growth, age, direction and death are crowding up. That is what, from this point of view, irreversibility in world processes has to mean. It is the expression no longer of the physical T, but of genuine historical, inwardly experienced time, which is identical with destiny. Baroque physics was, root and branch, a strict systematic, and remained so for as long as its structure was not racked by theories like these, as long as its field was absolutely free from anything that expressed accident and mere probability. But directly these theories come up, it becomes physiognomic. The course of the world is followed out. The idea of the end of the world appears, under the veil of formulae that are no longer in their essence formulae at all. Something Goethean has entered into physics, and if we understand the deeper significance of Goethe's passionate polemic against Newton in the Farben Lehre, we shall realize the full weight of what this means. For therein intuitive vision was arguing against reason, life against death, creative image against normative law. The critical form world of nature knowledge came out of nature feeling, God feeling, as the evoked contrary. Here, at the end of the late period, it has reached the maximal distance and is turning to come home. So once more, the imaging power that is the efficient in dynamics conjures up the old great symbol of Faustian man's historical passion, care. The outlook into the farthest far of past and future, the back-looking study of history, the foreseeing state, the confessions and introspections, the bells that sounded all over our countrysides and measured the passing of life. The ethos of the word time, as we alone feel it, as instrumental music alone, and no statue plastic can carry it, is directed upon an aim. This aim has been figured in every life image that the West has conceived, as the Third Kingdom, as the New Age, as the task of mankind, as the issue of evolution. And it is figured as the destined end state of all Faustian nature in entropy. Directional feeling, a relation of past and future, is implicit already in the mythic concept of force on which the whole of this dogmatic form world rests, and in the description of natural processes it emerges distinct. It would not be too much, therefore, to say that entropy, as the intellectual form in which the infinite sum of nature events is assembled as a historical and physiognomic unit, tacitly underlay all physical concept formation from the outset, so that when it came out, as one day it was bound to come out, it was as a discovery of scientific induction claiming support from all the other theoretical elements of the system. The more dynamics exhausts its inner possibilities as it nears the goal, the more decidedly the historical characters in the picture come to the front, and the more insistently the organic necessity of destiny asserts itself side by side with the inorganic necessity of causality, and direction makes itself felt along with capacity and intensity, the factors of pure extension. The course of this process is marked by the appearance of whole series of daring hypotheses, all of like sort, which are only apparently demanded by experimental results, and which, in fact, world feeling and mythology imagined as long ago as the Gothic Age. Above all, this is manifested in the bizarre hypotheses of atomic disintegration, which elucidate the phenomena of radioactivity, and according to which uranium atoms that have kept their essence unaltered, in spite of all external influences, for millions of years, quite suddenly, without assignable cause, explode, scattering their smallest particles over space with velocities of thousands of kilometers per second. Only a few individuals in an aggregate of radioactive atoms are struck by destiny thus, the neighbours being entirely unaffected. Here too, then, is a picture of history and not nature, and although statistical methods here also prove to be necessary, one might almost say that in them mathematical number has been replaced by chronological. With ideas like these, the mythopoetic force of the Faustian soul is returning to its origins. It was at the outset of the Gothic, just at the time when the first mechanical clocks were being built, that the myth of the world's end, Ragnarok, the twilight of the gods, arose. It may be that, like all the reputedly old German myths, Ragnarok, whether in the Voluspa form or as the Christian Muspeli, was modelled more or less on classical and particularly Christian apocalyptic motifs. Nevertheless, it is the expression and symbol of the Faustian and of no other soul. The Olympian College is historyless. It knows no becoming, no epochal moments, no aim. But the passionate thrust into distance is Faustian. Force, will, has an aim, and where there is an aim, there is, for the inquiring eye, an end. That which the perspective of oil painting expressed by means of the vanishing point, the Baroque park by its point de vue, and analysis by the nth term of an infinite series, the conclusion, that is, of a willed directedness, assumes here the form of the concept. The Faust of the second part is dying, for he has reached his goal. What the myth of Götterdämmerung signified of old, the irreligious form of it, the theory of entropy, signifies today. World's end as completion of an inwardly necessary evolution. 15. It remains now to sketch the last stage of Western science. From our standpoint of today, the gently sloping route of decline is clearly visible. This too, the power of looking ahead to inevitable destiny, is part of the historical capacity that is the peculiar endowment of the Faustian. The classical died, as we shall die, but it died unknowing. It believed in an eternal being, and to the last it lived its days with frank satisfaction, each day spent as a gift of the gods. But we know our history. Before us there stands a last spiritual crisis that will involve all Europe and America. What its course will be, late Hellenism tells us. The tyranny of the reason, of which we are not conscious, for we are ourselves its apex, is in every culture an epoch between man and old man, and no more. Its most distinct expression is the cult of exact sciences, of dialectic, of demonstration, of causality. Of old, the Ionic, and in our case the Baroque, were its rising limb. And now the question is, what form will the down curve assume? In this very century, I prophesy, the century of scientific critical Alexandrianism, of the great harvests, of the final formulations, a new element of inwardness will arise to overthrow the will to victory of science. Exact science must presently fall upon its own keen sword. First, in the 18th century, its methods were tried out. Then, in the 19th, its powers. And now its historical role is critically reviewed. But from skepsis there is a path to second religiousness, which is the sequel and not the preface of the culture. Men dispense with proof, desire only to believe and not to dissect. The individual renounces by laying aside books. The culture renounces by ceasing to manifest itself in high scientific intellects. But science exists only in the living thought of great savant generations. And books are nothing if they are not living and effective in men worthy of them. Scientific results are merely items of an intellectual tradition. It constitutes the death of a science that no one any longer regards it as an event, and an orgy of 2 centuries of exact scientificness brings satiety. Not the individual, the soul of the culture itself has had enough, and it expresses this by putting into the field of the day ever smaller, narrower, and more unfruitful investigators. The great century of the classical science was the 3rd, after the death of Aristotle. When Archimedes died and the Romans came, it was already almost at its end. Our great century has been the 19th. Savants of the calibre of Gauss and Humboldt and Helmholtz were already no more by 1900. In physics as in chemistry, in biology as in mathematics, the great masters are dead, and we are now experiencing the decrescendo of brilliant gleaners who arrange, collect, and finish off like the Alexandrian scholars of the Roman age. Everything that does not belong to the matter-of-fact side of life, to politics, technics, or economics, exhibits the common symptom. After Lysippus, no great sculptor, no artist as man of destiny appears, and after the Impressionists, no painter, and after Wagner, no musician. The age of Caesarism needed neither art nor philosophy. To Eratosthenes and Archimedes, true creators, succeed Posidonius and Pliny, collectors of taste, and finally Ptolemy and Galen, mere copyists. And just as oil painting and instrumental music ran through their possibilities in a few centuries, so also dynamics, which began to bud about 1600, is today in the grip of decay. But before the curtain falls, there is one more task for the historical Faustian spirit, a task not yet specified, hitherto not even imagined as possible. There has still to be written a morphology of the exact sciences, which shall discover how all laws, concepts, and theories inwardly hang together as forms, and what they have meant as such in the life course of the Faustian culture. The retreatment of theoretical physics, of chemistry, of mathematics as a sum of symbols. This will be the definitive conquest of the mechanical world aspect by an intuitive, once more religious, world outlook. A last master effort of physiognomic to break down even systematic and to absorb it as expression and symbol into its own domain. One day we shall no longer ask, as the 19th century asked, what are the valid laws underlying chemical affinity or diamagnetism? Rather, we shall be amazed indeed that minds of the first order could ever have been completely preoccupied by questions such as these. We shall inquire whence came these forms that were prescribed for the Faustian spirit. Why had they come to our kind of humanity particularly and exclusively? And what deep meaning there is in the fact that the numbers that we have won became phenomenal in just this picture-like disguise. And, be it said, we have today hardly yet an inkling of how much in our reputedly objective values and experiences is only disguise, only image and expression. The separate sciences, epistemology, physics, chemistry, mathematics, astronomy, are approaching one another with acceleration, converging towards a complete identity of results. The issue will be a fusion of the form worlds, which will present on the one hand a system of numbers, functional in nature and reduced to a few ground formulae, and on the other a small group of theories, denominators to those numerators, which in the end will be seen to be myths of the springtime under modern veils. Reducible, therefore, and at once of necessity reduced, to picturable and physiognomically significant characters that are the fundamentals. This convergence has not yet been observed, for the reason that since Kant, indeed since Leibniz, there has been no philosopher who commanded the problems of all the exact sciences. Even a century ago, physics and chemistry were foreign to one another. But today they cannot be handled separately. Witness spectrum analysis, radioactivity, radiation of heat. While 50 years ago the essence of chemistry could still be described almost without mathematics, today the chemical elements are in course of volatilizing themselves into the mathematical constants of variable relation complexes. And with the sense comprehensibility of the elements goes the last trace of magnitude, as the term is classically and plastically understood. Physiology is becoming a chapter of organic chemistry and is making use of the methods of the infinitesimal calculus. The branch of the older physics, distinguished according to the bodily senses concerned in each as acoustics, optics, and heat, have melted into a dynamic of matter and a dynamic of ether. And these again can no longer keep their frontiers mathematically clear. The last discussions of epistemology are now uniting with those of higher analysis and theoretical physics to occupy an almost inaccessible domain, the domain to which, for example, the theory of relativity belongs, or ought to belong. The sign language in which the emanation theory of radioactivity expresses itself is completely desensualized. Chemistry, once concerned with defining as sharply as possible the qualities of elements, such as valency, weight, affinity, and reactivity, is setting to work to get rid of these sensible traits. The elements are held to differ in character according to their derivation from this or that compound. They are represented to be complexes of different units, which indeed behave, actually, as units of a higher order, and are not practically separable, but show deep differences in point of radioactivity. Through the emanation of radiant energy, degradation is always going on, so that we can speak of the lifetime of an element, in formal contradiction with the original concept of the element and the spirit of modern chemistry as created by Lavoisier. All these tendencies are bringing the ideas of chemistry very close to the theory of entropy, with its suggestive opposition of causality and destiny, nature and history. And they indicate the paths that our science is pursuing, on the one hand, towards the discovery that its logical and numerical results are identical with the structure of the reason itself, and on the other, towards the revelation that the whole theory which clothes these numbers merely represents the symbolic expression of Faustian life. And here, as our study draws to its conclusion, we must mention the truly Faustian theory of aggregates, one of the weightiest in all this form world of our science. In sharpest antithesis to the older mathematic, it deals not with singular quantities, but with the aggregates constituted by all quantities, or objects, having this or that specified morphological similarity. For instance, all square numbers, or all differential equations of a given type. Such an aggregate it conceives as a new unit, a new number of higher order, and subjecting it to criteria of new and hitherto quite unsuspected kinds, such as potency, order, equivalence, countableness, and devising laws and operative methods for it in respect of these criteria. Thus is being actualized a last extension of the function theory. Little by little, this absorbed the whole of our mathematic, and now it is dealing with variables by the principles of the theory of groups in respect of the character of the function, and by those of the theory of aggregates in respect of the values of the variables. Mathematical philosophy is well aware that these ultimate meditations on the nature of number are fusing with those upon pure logic, and an algebra of logic is talked of. The study of geometrical axioms has become a chapter of epistemology. The aim to which all this is striving, and which in particular every nature researcher feels in himself as an impulse, is the achievement of a pure numerical transcendence, the complete and inclusive conquest of the visibly apparent, and its replacement by a language of imagery unintelligible to the layman and impossible of sensuous realization, but a language that the great Faustian symbol of infinite space endows with the dignity of inward necessity. The deep skepticism of these final judgments links the soul anew to the forms of early Gothic religiousness. The inorganic, known and dissected world around, the world as nature and system, has deepened itself until it is a pure sphere of functional numbers. But as we have seen, number is one of the most primary symbols in every culture, and consequently the way to pure number is the return of the waking consciousness to its own secret, the revelation of its own formal necessity. The goal reached, the vast and ever more meaningless and threadbare fabric woven around natural science, falls apart. It was, after all, nothing but the inner structure of the reason, the grammar by which it believed it could overcome the visible and extract therefrom the true. But what appears under the fabric is once again the earliest and deepest, the myth, the immediate becoming, life itself. The less anthropomorphic science believes itself to be, the more anthropomorphic it is. One by one it gets rid of the separate human traits in the nature picture, only to find at the end that the supposed pure nature which it holds in its hand is humanity itself, pure and complete. Out of the Gothic soul grew up, till it overshadowed the religious world picture, the spirit of the city, the alter ego of irreligious nature science. But now, in the sunset of the scientific epoch and the rise of victorious skepsis, the clouds dissolve and the quiet landscape of the morning reappears in all distinctness. The final issue to which the Faustian wisdom tends, though it is only in the highest moments that it has seen it, is the dissolution of all knowledge into a vast system of morphological relationships. Dynamics and analysis are in respect of meaning, form, language, and substance, identical with Romanesque ornament, Gothic cathedrals, Christian-German dogma, and the dynastic state. One and the same world feeling speaks in all of them. They were born with, and they aged with, the Faustian culture. And they present that culture in the world of day and space as a historical drama. The uniting of the several scientific aspects into one will bear all the marks of the great art of counterpoint, an infinitesimal music of the boundless world space. That is the deep, unresting longing of this soul, as the orderly, statuesque, and Euclidean cosmos was the satisfaction of the classical. That, formulated by a logical necessity of Faustian reason as a dynamic imperative causality, then developed into a dictatorial, hard-working, world-transforming science, is the grand legacy of the Faustian soul to the souls of cultures yet to be, a bequest of immensely transcendent forms that the heirs will possibly ignore. And then, weary after its striving, the Western science returns to its spiritual home.